Hello, 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 everyone. Welcome back to Safe Space, the ABA podcast. I am your host, Michelle Zeman, and I am super excited to be talking with you with our guests today. So be sure to look out for your two code words. So that way you can get your free BACBCEUs. So our guest for today, really wonderful human being. I'm super excited to introduce you to her. So she is the owner of Blossom Behavioral Solutions, and she's also an author. She wrote the book, The Adventures of Willow and Finding Forever. Very excited to talk about that as well. So please welcome Lindsay Lundquist to the podcast. Welcome, Lindsay.
Thank you, Michelle. I'm so excited to be here and be able to connect with you and talk more about Blossom Behavioral Solutions and The Adventures of Willow.
Yeah, I'm super excited to talk to you about those today too. So, first and foremost, what inspired you to start Blossom Behavioral Solutions?
So, I've been in the field of ABA, Applied Behavior Analysis, since I think about 2016 when I started as an RBT. So, I was kind of just going through the motions and RBT. Fell in love with it. So I started my master's in applied behavior analysis. And then in 2020, I passed my board exam and became a BCBA. And just going through the process, you know, working through for like a traditional ABA company and going through the insurance model, what I really saw was lacking was being able to provide support for those who may not need 10, 15, 20 hours of ABA therapy per week, because it is a lot. We have kids full-time in school. We have kids who have after school and extracurriculars, and then they're required to do 10, 15, 20 hours of ABA. It was a lot. And then I was also seeing a need for those who weren't diagnosed with autism, that had behavioral concerns, that weren't benefiting from the traditional counseling. So I think that that's really what inspired it, was just being able to provide outside of that traditional model for those who may not have been able to access it due to, again, those limiting insurance rules with not having a diagnosis and not being able to commit to so many hours of therapy per week. And then just, I love, love, love the direct work. I love my RBTs. You know, I've had really great connections and students in the past that I've trained to be BCBAs. But one of the parts that I enjoyed most was working directly. I would always step in and model and just be present, because just that connection and that pairing with each client helped me to see what are the needs here, what is going on internally that's impacting behaviors or just skills.
Yeah, that is really awesome. And, you know, as you know, like when we are working with insurances, you know, we're expecting to, you know, request for so many hours a week, you know, because we want to make sure that we are, you know, not necessarily like trying to reach a specific profit margin, but we might say like, oh, you know, 20, 30 hours a week might be most effective. But, you know, you're saying in your model, you know, you're not requesting that much. You're doing sort of like a non-traditional approach. So talk a little bit about what that approach looks like and kind of like what your service provisions look like for the clients that you serve.
Yeah, absolutely. So I still do take insurance where I can. I'm not in network with every insurance, but I try to make sure if we can get services covered through the medical model, absolutely, because financials can be a barrier. So I have it separated out with applied behavior analysis through the insurance model, and then just more like behavior coaching. So I still do provide those ABA services, but again, just not as intensely. So with me providing those direct hours, I may request 1 to 3 hours per week, just depending on, again, what the client needs as well. Because if they need more, of course, I'm going to request more. Or if I get somebody who does need more, I will refer out to a traditional ABA company where they can get the services that they need. Now, some cannot commit to that, and they, you know, wait lists are so long, especially where I'm at. So that is another barrier. So we may get started, or I may see certain signs of a diagnosis without having it present yet. So I may refer out to getting a full like diagnostic evaluation and provide the behavior coaching as support in the meantime. But I think just working with the model that I do, I start with, 1 to 3 hours per week, just again, depending on who it is, similar to like a traditional counseling setup. We're doing one, sometimes 2 or 3 hours, depending on if I'm going into the daycares or settings like that per week, and just making sure that they're getting the services that they need. Also incorporating in the parents as well. So whether that be meeting with the parents separately or incorporating them into the session, that's a very big component. And then as we get going and as the progress is being made, then that's where we start fading. And we may do like once every other week, or fade from 3 to 1 hours a week as the progress is being made and as the family feels comfortable and the client also feels comfortable with the progress and being able to maintain that in the home. But I think the biggest part is that maintenance component, because sometimes we can fade too quickly and it's like, okay, we don't have any services, but what about, those isolated issues that come up? Hey, I'm having challenges in this area. Can we talk through this and practice skills on what I can do next time in those areas? So again, it just really is so client depending.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because you do a lot of you do what sounds like a combination of ABA and mental health counseling. It's not, you're not doing counseling like you would like a mental health counselor would do talk therapy or do, any type of therapy. But that being said, what are the differences between what you do versus what mental health counseling specifically does and targets?
So I think the biggest difference is like mental health counseling. You go and generally you talk, you're there to work on skills too, but it's to really process through those emotions and heal like the past traumas. And what I do is I take the ACT-based acceptance and commitment therapy-based approach, as well as, the applied behavior analysis approach, and really focus on, okay, we can talk through those situations and what are your emotions and internal thoughts and feelings that are influencing it, because that does influence our behaviors, and figuring out a way to take action moving forward. How can we have done that differently going forward? How can we find accommodations for you? How can you advocate for yourself? What can you better and improve on your skills? And helping each individual to start to analyze their own behavior, set their own goals, how, prompt fading is in there as well. Sometimes I'm the one like prompting, like, wait, what about this goal instead? Setting those small attainable goals, but still finding the value, helping them figure out what are my barriers. And a lot of times that can be those internal thoughts and feelings and the psychological inflexibility. So I'm really trying to create that forward action versus the mental health is really addressing, like, I feel like the past. And again, I'm not trained in mental health counseling, so I could be totally wrong on that. But that's how I try and explain it. Like, if you're really just wanting to go talk about your thoughts and feelings and trying to process through that, that's where I do have those, my clients seeing mental health professionals as well. Or if there's like specific traumatic events. So like I am a certified clinical trauma specialist, but I don't advertise that I treat trauma. I use that as the knowledge of how I can understand that in the client's past and the behaviors and moving forward, because their nervous system impacts the behaviors, or they're correlated in some way. So that's where I try and keep those two separate.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you mentioned the nervous system when you're addressing things in your behavior therapy sessions. So that being said, why do you feel it's crucial to address the nervous system when you're doing the sessions with your clients?
I think that is really part basis too for the behaviors. Because if we think about it, there's the trigger, antecedent, what comes before the behavior, the trigger. And our body goes into, with the nervous system, when we're triggered, fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. And with that, there's so many behaviors associated with each of those individual like responses, right? Fight mode, you have yelling, saying hurtful things, aggression, destruction. Flight mode, you have elopement, running away, avoiding a situation. Freeze mode, you may have a meltdown. So I think that understanding that the trigger and the nervous system are so connected and impacting those behaviors, we have to address the emotional regulation component first. if someone's in fight mode or flight mode, freeze mode, whatever it may be, they can't exhibit the skill that they may need to in the moment. So we first need to go back and help them teach the skill of emotional regulation in order for the brain to even be able to process the skill that needs to be had, because they may have the skill, right? But when they're triggered, it's like the brain has different areas as different islands, and you have different skills on each island. But then when you're triggered, those bridges to those islands to access those skills are broken down. So they may not be able to communicate how, you know, they could have 2 hours ago or in the past with that same situation or a similar situation. So we have to repair those bridges in order to access and teach those skills.
That's so interesting. I would have never really thought about it like that, you know, because our clients engage in behaviors and, you know, we seek to try to like redirect and do behavior de-escalation. But, you know, just from my perspective, I don't really look at that. You know, I sort of look at like, okay, now our kid has escalated. Now we need to look at the consequence strategies, you know? So it's just so interesting to me to hear about like how the nervous system can connect.
Yeah, absolutely. It is very fascinating. And that's why I loved going through the certified clinical trauma specialist, like certification, because I was able to learn so much about that and the impact, because ultimately, you know, anything that happens after the behavior is a consequence, whether it be positive, negative, like we have those consequences naturally. But we have to be able to regulate the nervous system. And sometimes that does look like redirecting in the moment. Maybe it does look like shifting the conversation to something preferred to shift the mind away from that trigger in the moment. But we're going to circle back around to it at some point in time to be able to focus on skill building. Hey, I know that was really challenging for you. Can we try and figure out what we can do next time, or what skill can we practice in these moments? And helping
Absolutely.
Parents to realize that too, because then you have the behaviors from the child when they're in a triggered state, triggering the parents sometimes, then they're feeding off of each other. But think about it with yourself too. Like, how many times have you gotten really frustrated or had a meltdown because it was one obstacle after the next and just felt so overwhelmed? Like, can you be able to do those skills all the time effectively? But then you're like, not forcing, but almost like requiring a child to be able to do so.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Especially in those moments, you know, when a child is so heightened, you know, it's almost, it's challenging to kind of redirect that. I mean, even as an adult, you know, with autism, I find myself sort of like thinking about different ways, like I've been able to regulate my own emotions and sort of thinking about like, if someone were to have taught me different ways growing up of how to regulate my emotions, you know, there would be, I would imagine that there would be some circumstances where it would be a little harder for me to process some of those emotions and, you know, redirect my own brain into going in a different path. But then I feel too, like there, if there were enough strategies that were discovered, then that would be a whole different story, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And emotional regulation looks different for everyone. And I tell that to my clients too. Like, what I give you as tools may not be effective for you. So let's try it and see if it works. If it doesn't, we're going to find another strategy that works for you, because everybody is different in what's going to help them regulate. So if we're going into fight mode, we're going to want to find tools that exhibit that same energy. Right. So for, you know, going into fight mode, maybe you go to the gym, maybe you punch a pillow, maybe you have to get that energy out. Same thing with freeze. If you're in freeze mode, what happens is you're shutting down. Think of like even doom scrolling these days, because that's so prevalent with a lot of teens, is like, I'm just going to shut down and go into doom scrolling and not do anything else around me. Well, to get started, we have to move. What is the opposite? The incompatible of sitting down and freezing and doom scrolling is moving. Whether it be like going for a walk or anything like that, we have to figure out those incompatibles and regulating and those effective tools for each individual.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I'm so used to hearing the zones of regulation and, you know, what to do within the zones of regulation, how you might feel, and different strategies that might work, but then there's also some that might not work. You know, like some kids who are feeling like they're in like the blue zone, which the blue zone is more like the they're past the escalation, they're more like terrified, they're feeling sick even. And you know, some of the strategies that have been listed on there, like, you know, stretching out, and you know, sometimes that works for kids and sometimes that really doesn't work for kids. So it's really, I feel like it's all about finding what's individual to the client at the end of the day.
Absolutely, because age can play a role too. You know, if 4 to 5 year olds may not be able to emotionally regulate the same way, you know, a 15, 16 year olds might be able to because of, you know, self-awareness developing over time. I mean, even the brain, which so young, just developmentally can't emotionally regulate by themselves. So that's where co-regulation is going to be so important. If a child, even if they're 10, 11, 12, isn't able or has the skill to regulate by themselves, we need that co-regulation to be able to help them.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that being said, too, I'm super curious to know, what does a trauma-informed approach mean to you, and how do you apply it within your sessions?
I think what it means to me is understanding again how the nervous system works with a trigger, and then also going through and with the history. Is there any trauma or potentially like traumatic events that have happened? So that's something I always ask about in intake forms and things like that. Have parents experienced trauma? Like, what is going on in that family dynamic? And even like right off the get-go, and how I start sessions is I go over the history in the background, but I make sure to schedule that parent interview separate from the child. I never have the child anymore. And, you know, in the past with the traditional model, you know, sometimes I had to, or that's how I was trained to do it. But really, since I've started Blossom, is we are not going to have the child present during that initial evaluation because we may be talking about some negative behaviors or history or things the child may not know. And I want the child to come in then feeling very positive. And we're only going to talk about the positive in front of the child unless we are incorporating everybody together. So if, you know, the parent's trying to directly talk to me, I'm going to incorporate the child into that as well, whether it be, you know, a younger child, a teen. Hey, what do you think about that? You know, I know this is what mom just said. What are your thoughts on that? To really try and reinforce just even positive communication between that parent-child dynamic, because I can see that is also a barrier too, is children, adolescents not communicating with the parent, but then, you know, I get that communication. They don't get the communication, so things are different, and then the conflict happens. So, really, just focusing on that dynamic as well and being able to understand, like, okay, I'm not going to push you to trigger, like, my goal is not to trigger the behaviors, right? If they happen, they're going to happen, but we're going to take a step down. So, like, I guess going back to how I was always trained in the behaviors are going to get worse before they get better. You're going to see a spike because we're practicing and we're triggering behaviors in some sense because we're working on the triggers. But why does it have to get worse before it gets better? Why can't we be at like a stable, you know, baseline, and then, you know, we may start to get triggered, but that's when we're going to implement strategies to come back down because we don't want to keep sending the nervous system into a triggered state because the brain cannot learn.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and I'm glad that you mentioned, you know, not having the child involved in those intakes, because from my experience and just working with, you know, students in general, and it doesn't matter the age of the client, client dignity has to come first. You know, when we're talking negatively or when we are talking about very traumatic situations and the child is there, it doesn't matter if they are able to speak. It doesn't matter if they're not able to speak, doesn't matter how they're able to process that. Our clients pick up on things a lot quicker, and also they understand so much of what we talk about. You know, there you may not see the awareness, but they are aware.
Exactly. And that's why it's so important. And even to teach parents that as well, you know, so and so like is overhearing me in the room. You know, you may be talking about the child, and I'm getting the child, like my parents are saying, so like these comments behind my back, or sister and mom are talking about this, and I hear it. And even if they're in their other room, you still might hear the negative. So, doing the best you can to keep those negative conversations about behaviors or those challenges away if possible.
Absolutely, absolutely. I feel that that's so critical to understand. And even for even just having conversations with parents about their children and stuff, also looking at trauma too. I mean, trauma is not just neglect and abuse. It's any significant change that has happened that has changed the child's behavior in one way or another. And that's where it's like we have to be really careful with how we're going to, approach a situation and approach, the clients that we serve. So, I really commend what you do because, what you're doing is really just so, so positive for the clients that you're serving.
Oh, I appreciate that. And even just something I've learned too is the majority of the population we work with are neurodivergent, right? And with trauma, their brains are more susceptible to trauma. And because the trigger is kind of what happens is you have the external stimuli as the trigger, and it's almost like a stereo, right? The noise gets turned up in a neurodivergent, so it starts spiking all of those different like light bulbs going off in the brain. Versus with the neurotypical, you might be able to have that trigger, but it's turning the stereo down. Like you notice it and then it's kind of gone. So with the differences in how the brain processes, that's also very important to be aware of when we're implementing therapy and working with the kiddos that we work with.
Absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things that you talked about was parent coaching and how critical of a component it is within your therapy model. But for that parent education piece, I guess, thinking about children that are perceived as more like on the argumentative side, how do you help parents and any sort of like educators understand their tone or behavior from the child's point of view, thinking about trauma, thinking about the events that they've gone through in their life?
That's actually a really good question because that is a topic that I'm working very heavily on with one family dynamic right now. And I think, like you said, that educational component. So really making sure that, again, I'm talking with the parents separately, but also eventually I do bring this parents in with the teen as well, because we want to make sure that we're fostering the communication between the two. But right now, I think because sometimes that tone of voice can appear to be argumentative, or not even just the tone, but the language and how the language is processed, right? So in this specific situation, it's always a but this, but this, but this. So it's always like appearing to be a defense. However, when going deeper, the client is able to explain it's not always coming from a defense, it's coming from an adding an additional explanation. But because of the tone of voice and how often it's happening within certain contexts, it's coming off as argumentative. So then parents are getting frustrated because they're like, so and so is being disrespectful because they're arguing with me. So I think the primary basis when I first start with the parent coaching aspect is providing education on how the autistic and ADHD, neurodivergent, anxious brain is working and what's going on inside of their body that when they're expressing to me, and again, keeping the autonomy as well. So I will always ask, especially with, my adolescents, are you okay if I share this with, your parents? Are you okay if I explain it this way to help you guys in this situation? Just being very mindful of that information because I have to build that sense of safety and trust as well with each client too. So
Oh,
I think really, God.
I was to say, go absolutely.
Yes, it's so important. So that way, because I know even like with mental health counselors and because some of my kiddos have tried that before and they're like, well, I just felt like they were telling everything to my parent. And so that's something that is important to me too. Like, hey, I really think that this is something we should talk to them about. What are your thoughts? Can I frame it this way? And sometimes they are like, well, I don't know. I don't want them to get mad. I don't want them to yell at me. Well, that's my job is to be able to help them not, react to you. So if I can help foster that communication, generally we have a better response out of whatever situation and conversation it is. And then there's some kind of understanding. But again, it starts with that education and helping the parents understand that this is what's going on in the brain. What's intended may not be what's perceived on the outside. So I think that really working through that dynamic.
I appreciate that you bring up, incorporating parents in the session, but also respecting client's autonomy and the child's autonomy. Because, for me personally, I've worked with parents who sort of still feel like they have to be on the defensive, even though the client's just trying to express themselves. They're just trying to explain like what's going on. And, for me, it's one of those situations where that education piece really does matter in that regard, because we as BCBAs tend to focus on teaching our clients like, how can we say this better? How can we word this in a way that is going to appease others? But what if like the client is actually saying this, not to be defensive, not to be disrespectful, but just to kind of like make a point,
Yeah, and that kind of goes almost in a way to like, I don't know if it's like societal norms, but you're taught, do as I say, not as I do is a big, topic that I was given way back when I was a kid. Like, do as I say, not as I do. But we model actions, and sometimes, things are shifting, right? What's more acceptable, and being able to explain something. We want somebody to have a voice and be able to, communicate it respectfully, though. So we may need to shape up the language over time, but would you rather get some kind of communication language, or would you rather get, like yelling or no language at all? So trying to reinforce and shape that over time, and then coming in it from, being respectful to the parents. It also comes with our soft skills as a BCBA too, and how you communicate that to the parents, because you don't want to come in and say, oh, you're doing this wrong. You shouldn't be using this language with your client. We need to cater everything to the client. But hey, I wonder if we tried it this way, because I wonder if this is how so and so is processing. And I wonder if this might be more helpful for you to understand each other and get a better outcome.
I appreciate that you bring up soft skills because, a lot of people that I know that are BCBAs get a little bit intimidated by that parent coaching. And, it's because of the soft skills. It's because, they're not 100% sure how to explain how, they might approach a situation or how they might try things differently. And every parent works very differently. Every BCBA works very differently. And so does every child, So, we're not going to sit here and say, oh, you're doing this wrong, oh, you're doing that wrong, but rather like, okay, what if we do this instead? One thing that I've noticed is when blank does this, then they tend to respond a little better. Would you be open to trying that? I know that soft skills is definitely one of those challenging areas in some cases, but that being said, it's something to really that's something that has really humbled me as a BCBA is kind of like understanding how we can apply soft skills in a variety of settings and a variety of circumstances,
Yeah, I would agree, because just full transparency, when I first started, I did not have those soft skills. I remember my supervisors, and like that was a big topic because I was never taught them. I didn't know what I was, doing in that regard. Not that I was coming across like mean, but I can understand like where I would get feedback even from RBTs that I was intimidating because I, didn't always have the soft skills, but a lot of it was just me being anxious inside, like, I don't know what I'm doing. So then I freeze up, so then it appears to be more like blunt or like intimidating than it might have been. So it definitely takes time to shape our own behaviors as BCBAs over time. But yeah, the
Absolutely.
soft skills are so important. Like I noticed this, like, I wonder, like, how can I support you? Will this work for you? Because I'll even say, like, I don't want to come and tell you what to do. Like, I want to be able to support you, because if I give you all these strategies and you can't feasibly implement them, then it's not socially valid. So I'll give you some
Right.
suggestions. Which ones do you want to try? Which ones do you think you can confidently work on? Otherwise, what are we doing? We're not creating that long-term sustainable change.
Absolutely, absolutely. And when it comes to those soft skills too, we don't learn them in grad school, and no one really teaches us how to apply soft skills. So I feel like that's kind of something that has just kind of come over time, but it's one of those things that will really humble you once you like truly learn. So,
Agreed. Yeah, you can, read about it in a textbook, but unless you're practicing it over time, like you're not going to be able to make those positive changes.
absolutely, absolutely. Well, I want to go ahead and drop our first code word for the podcast, and that code word is blossom. That is BLOSSOM. That is the word blossom. So I kind of want to move into the author side. I am super excited to talk about this because you've written books like The Adventures of Willow. So first, what inspired you to write this book? And also for Finding Forever as well, what inspired you?
So I think just, being a BCBA over time, I've written so many social stories for kids, right? There's so many teaching opportunities, so many social stories that I've written. And I think what truly like finally inspired me to start it was I had a supervisee who, PhD, like phenomenal human and I, in like other areas. So she was in education. And she was a children's author. I mean, she is an author. And she just kind of was like, why don't you just do it? Just do it. Just do it. So eventually I was like, all right, fine, I'll do it. She's like, write a story about Willow and all her adventures. And I just started it to because kids love, we need more reading, but I think kids love animals. Most kids love animals. And it's a way to be able to connect in a preference, right? We do preference assessments. How can you build on skills through your preferences and in the natural environment? And I think just being able to expand too, like way back when I first started and going through like all the different emotions and realizing some of the books that these kids are very drawn to in big popular books like Pete the Cat. Did Pete cry? Goodness, no. It's okay to cry. It's valid to cry, and it's how you move forward. So I think just even that piece of like, wait, these kids are loving, this series, which is, incredible. I'm not talking bad about any specific book series or anything like that, but just wanting to expand more on providing acceptance of emotions within books. So that's kind of just where I started. And we have book two in the works and it should be done in the next couple months. So just seeing all that come together is incredible. Because we have Finding Forever, which sets the premise for the series and all of Willow's adventures.
Oh, I love that so much. And it's so interesting because we talk about like social stories not necessarily being the greatest things out there, but at
Yeah.
the same time, you're creating these stories to help children understand their emotions and choices, and sort of like align with ACT principles. So, for those of us who haven't read the book or don't know much about the book, how would you say that your books align with your ACT principles and therapeutic practices?
I think just being able to incorporate the thoughts and feelings and emotions, right? We have values that's in there. What's valuable to somebody, being able to connect with somebody. As Willow goes along her adventure, she's going to encounter different obstacles that she's going to have to face. She's going to express different internal thoughts that she's having that she's going to have to face. Like what she's thinking is really out there in the book. Like Willow thought this, or internally, like this is what's happening for her, and how we can move forward in that connection as well. That mindfulness, being aware of what's going on around you. And I think the biggest part too is yes, there's the story, right? It's not all, you can only fit so many words on a page in a children's story. And I think the biggest part comes from the critical thinking component that it can allow, right? So why was Willow feeling upset in this situation? What could she have done? How could, the little boy who's falling on the floor crying could have responded? So I'm also in the process of making resources that will connect back to the book in that ACT-based manner for goal setting, identifying values, identifying emotions to be able to be that supplement to it. So it doesn't feel like this is just a book about learning, but there's so many learning opportunities within it.
Absolutely, and you mentioned building critical thinking skills and different activities can help with those critical thinking skills and those social skills. So how do some of those activities You know, like playing games, going for walks, contriving social situations, even like things from your books. How can they help children build those types of skills?
So one personal example is I have, you know, a friend's daughter who absolutely loves The Adventures of Willow. Like, it is her favorite story because she also knows Willow, right? It's just a personal connection to her as well. But the way that they're incorporating that into daily life is, you know, she'll reference the book in situations where the child might be struggling with this or that and be like, wait, think back to the book. What did Willow do when Willow was feeling that way? How can we respond different? And she's able to connect that back to something that was so preferred and like, oh, wait, this is what it is. And be able to problem solve and critically think in those situations. But even just that natural environment teaching is something that's so important to be able to build those critical thinking skills for kids. And the more that you're doing it through those play-based activities, those preferred activities, the more the learning is happening because the body is in a state where it is able to learn, right? Naturally, you know, you're going to lose in a game. You're not always going to win. So how can we build our skills through playing that board game? How can we communicate better? Wait, you said that, but what if someone at school got really, really mad at you and said this back to you because they didn't like how you said that in, you know, whatever game or natural situation it was? How can you respond to that? What could you have said differently? How can we build on you critically thinking about how to problem solve in a situation, but also just increasing your own self-awareness?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, skill building, critical thinking skills, those are all, you know, different types of goals that, you know, our clients can set, that we can set for our clients, and, you know, also making sure that that they're getting those opportunities to, you know, practice those. So that being said, what does goal setting look like within your sessions? And why do you focus on those small, attainable weekly goals for your clients?
I think goal setting looks different based on who it is, right? Some of my younger ones, they may have a hard time coming up with their own goals, or it's like, I want to be able to do this. More of like the fun activities of what they want to earn. But I'd say specifically with this conversation and focusing on like the adolescents, helping them identify their own goals while keeping in the mind, the back of my mind, like what are goals the parents have for the child as well, and how can I merge them together? But setting those small attainable goals, you feel more accomplished, right? So it's like a staircase. You can't reach the top of the staircase until you take each step. You want to be able to, you know, read a whole book for self-care this week, but you haven't picked up a book in months. What happens if you don't read the book? Are you going to start to feel bad about yourself? Like, I'm a failure. I didn't meet those goals. Let's start with, you know, one chapter of the book. Going to the gym. Maybe someone wants to go to the gym and start exercising more. I've had someone like, I want to go to the gym 5 times a week, but you're not even stepping foot in the gym 1 time a week. So we need to start to set those attainable goals in order for them to feel that success and that accomplishment to be able to build in a positive way going forward. But then it also comes in with like maintenance too. If you have one skill, you know, the prerequisite skill, you should then be able to move forward. If you can't reach that full skill, it's like riding a bike. If you can't even put your leg over to get on a bike, how can you ride a bike? So you have to have those prerequisite skills in order to achieve like your full skill.
Absolutely. You know, and it's so great that, you know, you focus on those small skills too, because, you know, we as BCBAs might look at like an assessment tool, for example, they might have like a huge criteria and we write that in our 6-month plan, which I'll be honest, I'm not perfect. I've done that before too. But that being said, it's like, oh, are we really like going too high? Like, you know, for example, I know that I've seen goals where it's like, oh, they're going to tack 50 items, but they haven't even tacked one. And so you're expecting them to tack 50 within 6 months when they haven't even labeled one thing, you know? So to me, like, to me, it sort of just humbles me again, where it's like, okay, we really do need to take a step back and sort of focus on building more of those smaller goals to help us reach that main, that big objective.
Absolutely. Cause you need to, even just for themselves too. Like you said, like if they can't tact 50, but you're putting in a goal for 50, like they can't even tact one, how would you expect them to do that 50? Cause then they may feel like a failure. I'm not meeting my goals. Again, depending on who it is. But setting those small attainable goals to set somebody up for success is very important.
Absolutely. How do you track, how do you use permanent products or self-reports to track progress with clients?
I think that comes in a lot with more of my older adolescents and teens. They sometimes we have like visual like checklists that they send home or I send home with them, and then they report back on a checklist. Sometimes it's, you know, the goal is maybe to have zero missing assignments for your homeschool class. So you're physically going to show me the platform, not just self-report that one. Maybe it's you record on your watch, I did, you know, this many workouts. Maybe it's you go into a social outing and you take a picture of yourself there because the phone is going to date and timestamp it. So we want to decrease that response effort, right? If you have this high response effort and you're like, I really don't want to do it, so you just don't end up doing it, you're not setting them up for success. So if I went home and, or, you know, sent them home and they're like, we have all of these things that I have to keep track of. Is that feasible? Is it even going to be accurate? Because then you could start with, you know, potentially reinforcing lying behaviors. So being able to really, I think, also help motivate them to create their own goals is helpful too, because they want to then achieve their goals, in certain situations.
Yeah, you know, one of the sad things about the insurance model is that a lot of the goals that our clients want to obtain might not look good on an insurance report. And it's like, come on now, you know, I want to help my client, you know, reach their own goals. And, you know, like kind of looking at the medical model of things, I've seen goals in some behavior intervention plans and in some functional behavior assessments where, you know, I've seen like the client came up with this goal on their own. And I'm sitting here and I'm like, I love this. I love this goal because they came up with it. But then insurance, you know, the battle of insurance. So that
Yes,
being
it is a
said,
big battle.
yeah, I was gonna say, do you have any advice for anybody who is sort of like fighting that battle with insurance of, you know, like the client is coming up with their goal. It might not look pretty on insurance land, in insurance land, but they came up with it, and that's what matters here.
I think some of it goes back to the wording. Again, medical necessity, we have to be able to follow like medical necessity rules. Some insurances have more stipulations. It has to be related to autism, the diagnosis. So being able to really reference why it's needed is important. So like maybe exhibit like restricted, you know, and rigid behaviors with adding in additional tasks to their day. So we need to add in those additional tasks to their day or find ways. Overall, for the most part, I don't get questioned too much with some of those goals, with more I keeping it more broad in the sense too of like client will identify one goal per week. Client will identify a barrier if they did not achieve their goal that week. Client will show permanent product to achieving their identified goal, to start to increase that self-management behaviors. And again, age really plays a role in this as well. Like a 5-year-old is not going to do that. But you know, your older clients might, and that will hopefully give them more autonomy as well. So I think again, just connecting it back to the larger picture, being very specific with your goals and how you're going to measure them and why it's needed. And again, every insurance is different. You're going to get, you know, the insurance companies coming back, like that's not a valid goal. But you can still find ways to incorporate them during sessions, right? Their goals we're working on, their preferences, there's ways to connect it back to applied behavior analysis so you're still remaining ethical with how you're implementing that treatment.
I love that. Thank you so much for providing that because, you know, on my end, like I want, you know, everyone to be able to have that autonomy, but also insurance tends to be like, you know, like, no, this isn't written the way that it should be written because, you know, it doesn't meet the medical necessity criteria for autism. So I appreciate you
Yeah.
sharing that.
And that's really where drawing it back to the, you know, characteristics or symptoms according to the DSM-5 of autism, those restricted and repetitive behaviors, resistance to change, you know, transitioning, all those things. The more you can be detailed as to like why it's important, I think that will also help you as well. And sometimes I will very much explain to parents, certain insurances are going to want me to be more strongly worded. So this might be how it's worded. But know that we are still incorporating all those like trauma-informed naturalistic teaching opportunities within those goals.
Agreed. Agreed. I love that so much. One of the things that you mentioned earlier was bi-weekly and monthly sessions for maintenance. How do they differ from your traditional ABA model? And what do those look like in your practice?
Yeah, so I think it kind of goes hand in hand too, because when I'm fading, even with like the insurance typical ABA model, we still will do those maintenance check-ins before we fully fade services, because you never know what's going to come up. We don't want to fade too quickly and then have to restart the initial assessment all over. So if I am out one time a week, we may fade to every other week just to make sure that we're maintaining that progress and checking in. With behavior coaching clients, it's what issues came up in the past couple of weeks that we can work on? What is coming up that you foresee being a challenge? Because I do have parents that are like, well, I'm hesitant to fully fade. We still need some support. You know, there's things that come up over time, especially with children and adolescents, you know, changes in routine, changes in family dynamics, issues at school with peers, puberty plays a role that might affect things, illness, you know, playing a role in there as well. So I think there's so many different things that, we're always working on building skills, even as adults. So like children also need that support as well. So how can we still work on that maintenance of the old skills? And then identify, okay, what do we need to focus on going forward for you to be successful?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I appreciate you explaining that so much, because, you know, one of the things that we try to do is we want to try and fade out, but at the same time, we want to make sure that we're in line with, you know, what fading out should look like, you know, and how we can best do it in a way that's supportive to the family and to the child at the end of the day.
Yeah. And if they need additional services in like other areas like mental health counseling or OT or speech or whatever it may be, I will suggest they go those routes too. It could be, you know, we met 2 weeks ago and the family is like, all right, well, things are overall going well. Let's still check in a month and make sure that we're maintaining that. Okay. Things are still going well. Do we want to push it out further? We had a situation come up and, you know, behaviors are spiking over, you know, break or something like that. Let's meet a little bit sooner, get back on track, and then fade back out to make sure that we're maintaining.
I love that so much. I love that so, so much. Very cool. Well, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our second code word, and that second code word is Willow. That is W-I-L-L-O-W. That is Willow. So a couple more questions I have. So for supervisees or doctorate students, you know, those who want to go into this field and want to expand their education further, how do you mentor them to create impactful social emotional resources?
So I don't provide direct supervision at this time, but I do provide that mentorship component. So if they're in like their grad school program, and I think because I don't have the means to do so at this point, like I don't have RBTs on staff, I don't, I may not have clients where I can give them the hours that they would need, but I do provide that mentorship. So I've had supervisees reach out like, hey, I'm seeking, you know, help in these areas. Can we talk about this? So, or even BCBAs that are seeking out mentorship as well, because I think that's so important to collaborate as well. Like I seek out mentorship too from multiple colleagues that are phenomenal in this field. So being able to go over their challenges, how are you practicing? What are some challenges you faced, and how can we help shape that a little bit? How can I provide you the trauma-informed support that you might need? Or maybe you overlooked this as a potential variable. So what if we try looking at this as a potential variable? And again, I'm not there in person with their cases, so I don't know. So, and it's again, like, I wonder if this could be a good option for you. If they need certain mentorship in different areas, I will point them in those directions, whether it's like, you know, research articles, trainings, like, hey, I did this really cool training and it seems to fit what we've talked about. Would you like to attempt this? Or, you know, here's the resources for that. Here's some great books. Here's whatever they feel like they need, even if it's just some emotional support, right? You know, BCBAs, it's tough, right? We are it is not an easy field, very much linked to burnout. And again, going with like imposter syndrome, the soft skills, how can I help you better your practice? Because I know what it was like when I first started and didn't have all of that support.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I appreciate that, like you, that collaboration is just so important. And, you know, we all come from different walks of life in this field. We all have different experiences. And so that collaboration, I feel, is just so important. I really appreciate that you take the time to do that for people that you mentor, people that, you know, reach out to you as well.
Yeah, it can always be good to just get a second opinion or talk something through and make sure you're on the right track. You could go to, you know, people within your company, but, you know, maybe you need an outside opinion. And I very much keep HIPAA, all of that very clear as well. So we don't discuss like client names or, you know, specific companies too. So I make sure that all of that is upheld and they're receiving the support and mentorship that they need. Because sometimes it can be hard to reach out to even, you know, supervisors in your own company for a collaboration if, you know, you're comparing yourself to other people or you're just like, I don't know if I like this. So being able to have just a second opinion can be helpful.
It really can be. I can tell you that. So as you look forward, where do you see the balance between traditional counseling, ABA, and mindfulness-based practices evolving within your work?
That's a good question. Everything is just evolving so much, even since I first started Blossom. So I think with the traditional counseling, if someone truly needs it, I absolutely refer and try and find that and make sure that we're dealing with that component of it. Now, I will get people who will start that and then they're like, wait, but, you know, we don't, or the therapist just doesn't understand autism and how the brain is processing with that. So it wasn't a good fit. So I think just continuing to incorporate and again, addressing if absolutely medically needed, the counseling, because I think that that plays a very crucial role, or medication management. So those are very separate things. Like I'm like, I don't diagnose, I don't provide medical treatment. Here's who you can talk to and how I can support you from my side. But just as ACT is growing so much, even in the past year, funny enough, I remember in grad school, we did something on ACT, and I remember doing absolutely terrible on those assignments. It was the one topic I could not understand to save my life. And now it's all I do because I understand it. I was like, this makes so much sense. But back then, my psychological inflexibility was so rigid and black and white when I was training in the field. So it comes back full circle. And I think just continuing to incorporate mindfulness and all of those like emotions and how it impacts the behavior with the different skills that we're teaching, right? I mean, mindfulness, we can go back to tacting, right? Label five things that are around you. What sensations do you feel? Like those are all skills. And I think the more that we understand how it relates to each other and impacts each other, I think the more it's going to grow in the fields.
I love that. I love that. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today. It's been an absolute joy talking with you about Blossom, a little bit about your book, and also a little bit about, you know, ABA counseling, the differences. I've really appreciated you coming onto the show and talking about that. Where can our listeners find you or contact you?
You can contact me through my website, so Blossom Behavioral Solutions. There's the Adventures of Willow part on it, and then there's also the services side too. Or on Instagram as the Mindful Behaviorist, the Adventures of Willow series, and Blossom Behavioral Solutions. We're everywhere just trying to separate it all and to make sure that each area of the business is very clear and separated. So whoever's seeking out certain support can find it in those areas.
I love it. Thank you so much, Lindsay. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to today's episode. I've been your host, Michelle Zeman, and I will see you on the next one. Bye, everyone.